I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Become a paid member, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and bonus episodes at decodingtv.com. Thanks so much to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
These women can assist you in preparation for your bath.
Thank you, but I've already bathed.
In the prison?
No, in the village.
But that was some time ago.
What, two baths in a week? What, do you want me to catch the flux?
I've never related more with a character than when he said, two baths in a week? What? Anyway. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen. Joining me, as always, he is Patrick Klepek. Patrick, how's it going today?
Good. How are you, David?
I am doing well. I've had a really intense week for reasons I can't get into, but I will be able to talk about them at some point. Joining me also today, you have seen her work as Jessie Gender on YouTube. Jessie Earl, welcome back to Decoding TV.
Hey, glad to be back. You pulled me out of the ether.
Always great to have the three of us, fighting through the world of television news and reviews and recaps together. It's a pleasure. So anyway, you can find more episodes of the show at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. And find us across all platforms. We're posting new videos basically every day on YouTube, on Instagram, and on TikTok at decodingtv. Follow us across all platforms. Today on the podcast, we are going to be discussing a bunch of television news, TV and movie industry news that's going on, entertainment industry news that's happening right now. And then we are going to be diving into reviews and recaps of the first three episodes of Constellation on Apple TV Plus, as well as the first two episodes of Shogun on FX Hulu. So that is what we'll be covering right here today on Decoding TV. Before we do that, though, I do want to do some follow-ups to our conversation last week. You know, Patrick Klepek, big follow-up. True Detective Night Country.
Mm.
Last week on the podcast, we shared our disappointment with True Detective Night Country and also Nick Pizzolatto's negative response to True Detective Night Country. And it turns out that Nick Pizzolatto, one of the only few people that were really unhappy with True Detective Night Country, because obviously the ratings were huge. And we learned, according to Variety, True Detective will be renewed for season 5 with Issa Lopez returning under a new HBO overall deal. Very exciting. Jesse Earl, did you indulge in True Detective Night Country by any chance?
Sadly, no, because I have actually never watched True Detective, and I did want to watch this season, but then I heard it had connections to season 1, and then hearing about all the crap that he was pulling, I'm like, I don't know if I want to watch season 1, so then I don't know if I'll watch season
2. Wow.
Fascinated to hear. I feel like you'd be best served watching that show with the furthest possible distance from everything that just happened. I think David and I did our best to like take it on its merits and take the show for what it presented itself as. But because it's been really so long since I've watched a show get such weird discourse attached to it course of its, like, it was in some way, because we were often talking about that in connection with the show, and I think we separated that properly, but you might be like, if you're at all interested, like in the lead up to whenever the next season comes out, watch that separated from all the BS, because hopefully you'll be able to just like it or not like it, like just separated from all of the online buzz for good or ill that happened during that show's run is probably for the best for the show and for you.
Honestly, yeah, I just watching it from a distance, I was just like, what is happening? This show is either the worst thing ever made or one of the best shows of the year. I could not parse which
one of those is it. The answer is yes.
Let's see, like, a lot of people are being stung by bees over there. Do I want to go walk over by those bees and get stung?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, exactly. There's a weird quantum state that this show is living in that I could not parse.
100% agreed. But hey, you know, the numbers don't lie. People really love this show. Some people really love the show, and certainly HBO was very happy with the results. So I'm actually excited. Issa Lopez, you know, despite the execution of True Detective Night Country, Patrick Klepek, I think you and I both agree Issa Lopez is a really strong and interesting voice, creative voice, and looking forward to see what else you might be able to come up with, even though I personally was very disappointed with Night Country, right?
I still remain pretty optimistic about. I'd be curious what changes, like, does she get the ability to say, like, hey, it's my anthology series now, because this is the first time since season one.
I am the captain now.
season one connections, like, off the ship. Like, we're done. You know what I mean? Like, it was unclear throughout all of her commentary about the show how much of how this was retrofitted into an existing franchise was her being a good soldier for HBO and finding a way to adapt her work, her vision into a way that was like a branding exercise. Like, hey, you want the budget? You want these actors? You want this marketing? This is how it happens. We attach you to, that's a very pragmatic approach. If now does she get a little more freedom? Like, I don't think, again, I'm not saying all the problems of Night Country were the result of like having True Detective attached. It had some core storytelling flaws, but maybe with like a little more confidence, a little more freedom, I am fascinated to see if what kind of direction she takes it in going forward, because she's a very strong visionary. And I think the storytelling was the clunkiest part of what happened here. Was able to get very evocative performances, evocative imagery. Yeah. So hopefully given some of those lessons, maybe, and also her first crack at a television show. You know, it's different to write a 90-minute film than it is to write 6 hours of television. So I don't know. Yeah. I remain hopeful, even if a lot of that is me still rooting for Tigers Are Not Afraid. And even if you did not like Night Country, go watch that film. It is astounding.
That I can second. That I have seen and did love that. So,
Jesse Earle, I'm also going to tell you that if you're afraid of missing all the connections to True Detective Season 1, I would not let that hold you back from watching Night Country.
It might be a benefit to not
know about it now.
So tenuous. The connections are so tenuous. Just enjoy Night Country on its own. I think you might have a good time with it.
All right.
A listener named Sem writes into decodingtv@gmail.com. Hey, fellas, really enjoyed your recap of True Detective Night Country. For the most part, we're in alignment. My personal opinion was left indifferent on the show. I was happy to see Jodie Foster back in high-level content via HBO, but True Detective as a series has never really hit, if you get what I'm saying. I'm one of those that thought the ending of season one was pretty lackluster for the build-up leading to it. Nick Pizzolatto, I don't think you needed to spend too much time on him, only because he's never been happy about True Detective, going back to season one. Everything I read about him and his thought on his work on HBO just made me think, this is an unhappy creative. I think a lot of creatives and Hollywood types are just like that. Whatever they're searching for or hoping to execute, they can never find or reach, and can always be found at a party, in a conversation, in a Variety interview, or on social media complaining about something. As for the show, it's far from the worst thing I've seen on TV, and more specifically, far from the worst thing I've seen on HBO. Think about later seasons of Game of Thrones, for example. But I will summarize my frustration and indifference to the series here. Until someone explains to me why the show opens with caribou jumping off a cliff, that scene and the fact that we don't come back to it is, in a nutshell, True Detective Season 4. So, end quote. It is debatable whether True Detective Season 4 ever explains what happened in the opening scene. I will not go into it for spoiler aversion, but I can understand why a lot of people are frustrated. I'll put it that way. So, anyway.
I don't like the phrase Jodie Foster. It's good to see Jodie Foster in high level content. It's an upsetting string of words. I got to be honest.
Patrick Klepek finds that upsetting as a phrase. Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for your reactions to our sort of thoughts on True Detective. Patrick Klepek, I think since you've been involved with the podcast, this is the most commentary we've ever gotten in reaction to our thoughts on a show. I would say
other than people wanting to go down to the ship called the SS Secret Invasion. I think it's the most. I think that's, you know, I mean, to the original point on why HBO would partner with her again. And like, look, like it, dislike it, wherever, like it was compelling. And it got people watching, and in an environment where it's difficult to grab eyeballs, and like, I'm not shocked that HBO would end up, you know, sticking with the creative that, hey, it got people talking and interested and fascinated in the show and where it's going. So I think that's to her credit.
It was kind of the same thing. It sounds like kind of the same thing we had with the Curse, where it was like, it's more interesting to have something to talk about that may have failed in the end in some eyes versus something that just was like, it hit all the beats you wanted to hit, but didn't really stimulate you in any other way intellectually. So
indeed. All right. A couple of other items of news we want to discuss. I mean, just a quick mention of some release dates that were dropped this last week. We learned that The Boys season 4 will be debuting on June 13th. Kind of excited about this one. Jesse, Earl, and I covered Gen V, right?
Yep, Gen V.
Gen V for Decoding TV. And Patrick Klepek, I think you're a fan of The Boys, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm
right?
up to the Boys, and I'm one episode left on Gen V. We finally picked up the second half of the season.
What do you think about it so far?
Incredible. Like, yeah. For this is how you do world building. Now, granted... Yeah. After the success of Gen V, as soon as you saw, let's do more. Let's build. As no, I really liked how you built this one brick. I don't know if you build five more bricks that they're all going to be this good. But I have found The Boys start to finish to be really actually a show I think that has gotten stronger as it's gone along. I found Gen V to be really remarkable television, much more diverse cast to care. I mean, top to bottom, I really enjoy that world.
We also got some details about The Acolyte, a mysterious Star Wars TV series that has been in development for quite some time. This is supposed to be debut a long time ago. It just got a release date of June 5th, 2024. I don't think that's an official release date yet, but that is what a lot of people are saying. So Leslie Headland is going to be in charge of that. She co-created Russian Doll, which I really loved, and also wrote Sleeping with Other People. The movie starring Jason Sudeikis and Alison Brie. Anyway, The Acolyte, that's a really just kind of curious what that's going to be. We know almost nothing, and it's only a few months away. So,
well, we do know its setting, right? Which is that it's set in an era of Star Wars that's been depicted in. It was a big comics push. The High
and
Republic,
novels
right?
as well. Yeah, novels as like, well. Yeah,
because there was a big like, hey, we're going to like flesh out this era from a couple of years back, in which there was a bunch of comics and novels that were pushing, but it hasn't been depicted on screen
the
or
end
in a
of
video
the High
game.
Republic, the end of the High Republic era.
Yeah,
but. Mm. Yeah, I don't think there's been any like trailer yet or anything like that, right?
No,
like,
I remember. Yeah.
So we'll see. Anyway, those are a couple quick release date pieces of information. There was an investor call with David Zaslav talking about Warner Media and all the stuff going on there. Things in general, as far like from a big picture business perspective. Things seem to not be going very well, from what I can tell. Like they put a bunch of chips on Max, the one to watch for HBO, and I remember they said, "Hey, we got to rename it from HBO Max to just Max because we have gone as far as we can go with the HBO name, guys, and we got to attract a bunch of new people." Well, those new people never really materialized, and so they are just kind of like the Max streaming growth. Is kind of stalled. It's not in a great place, but have no fear because David Zaslav has a bunch of hot properties that he has announced that are going to be debuting sometime on Max over the course of the next couple of years. One of the big ones is a Game of Thrones spinoff series called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, The Hedge Knight, which
snappy.
feels
snappy,
like
snappy title.
Rolls right
snappy
off the tongue.
Yeah. Doesn't feel like a title should have the word knight twice. Just going to put that out there. This is based off of the Dunk and Egg book / characters. And I'm actually really excited about this because House of the Dragon, I had some issues with it, but overall, really, really great show. And Duncan Egg theoretically is going to be more standalone, takes place like I think around 100 years before the events of Game of Thrones. And so I'm looking forward to seeing what they might be able to come up with a lower stakes, more standalone style series set in the Game of Thrones universe. Could be exciting. Jesse Earl, any thoughts on this?
No, other than I kind of hope it ends up being what the first season of The Witcher was, which The Witcher has a lot of problems, but I did enjoy that sort of like Monster of the Week style format. And then when it became much more serialized over the last two seasons, I've lost any and all interest. So I actually hope that like The Hedge Knight kind of falls into that same exact mold of like, let's just do one-off little stories within the Game of Thrones world. My only real hesitancy on it is just it's still a prequel. And I'm just kind of burnt on prequels and large franchises generally. I just kind of want like move it forward. Like as much as people derided it, I actually had some level of interest in like a Jon Snow spinoff series in the sense mm-hmm. that like it would have to be something new. It would have to be set like outside of the like main narrative of the show. It would have to be pushing forward. So I was curious what that was going to be, though. It doesn't seem like it's going to materialize. So yeah, I think there's potential here, but I'm still a little burnt on prequel franchise storytelling. So
depending on how this plays out, they could shift to an every other year Game of Thrones schedule for each show, kind of like a Call of Duty in the video game universe, where like every other year like one studio makes a Call of Duty game, you know, and then on the off years the other studio takes care. So you could have like House of the Dragon every 2 years, Duncan Egg every 2 years, depending on how the show goes. Patrick Klepek, you looking forward to this?
Yeah, I mean, look, the quality bar and so far on Game of Thrones post the original show is pretty high. I mean, the fact that they managed to burn tens of millions of dollars on an unaired pilot, I think goes to show the stuff they're going to greenlight, they have some confidence in. The only thing that gives me a little bit of pause is House of the Dragon was a show that went through HBO's quality control process prior to the existence of the Mr. Tax Break, Mr. Tax Write-Off. And so I'd like to hope that The Hedge Knight is coming from a place that it's, hey, this is following the same steps that we take. We're very careful with Game of Thrones. We would only put a series to green light if we absolutely felt like this was going to be a hit. But Warner Brothers, as you said, is in a precarious place financially. They're doing everything they can to get their financial house in order, mostly so they can get sold again. And that does not necessarily instill me with a confidence in the broader infrastructure of Warner Brothers and HBO to pull that off. So I hope I'm wrong there and that HBO can continue to remain sort of creatively insular from some of those pressures. But I don't know that you can look at the green lighting of this series separate from like the broader Warner Brothers project or I guess financial project. So as it is.
Patrick Klepek, I just want to say, how dare you imply that we will not get the highest of quality control? Now that Warner Brothers is run by the man who brought us shows like Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, Ghost Brothers, and Vampires in America. You know, like, I just don't get, sometimes I feel like I don't understand you at all, is kind of where I'm landing on this.
I know this. You mentioned this when you first interviewed me for the podcast. This was brought up as a character flaw. I've been working on it. I've been trying to watch these shows, but it's just not working, David. I'm just like, how many pimples do I have to watch pop before I just tell you I don't want to watch a pop? I don't care if they're in 4K.
Speaking of David Zaslav, he also announced that, they previously announced, hey, we're making a new Harry Potter series, right? They had previously announced this. That series has now been given a date, or a year, I should say. 2026 is when they are going to debut this new Harry Potter series. Now, a couple things we got to say about this. First of all, David Zaslav keeps saying something along the lines of the following. This is an exact quote from him this last week. Quote, "We've not been shy about our excitement about around Harry Potter. The last film was made more than a dozen years ago," end quote. I know he's talking about movies that say Harry Potter in the title, but I just don't understand why he feels the need to completely ignore Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore, which debuted in April of 2022.
I mean, there's a reason. He's definitely a reason he wants to ignore that movie.
And in fact, any Fantastic Beasts movie he does not seem to want to mention. But yes, theoretically, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Jesse, is this series is supposed to basically cover the same time frame as what was covered in the books. Is that correct?
presumably it's supposed to, I think they said they were going to recast the original trio and retell the story of the books just over a longer time frame, which, like, I get the to a degree where it's like, okay, the movies did compress a lot, so there is more story you could have told there, but... May I do a little rant? I don't want if you had more to say, I'll save my rant.
I want to hear the rant. I definitely want to get to the rant. Just a couple quick things before we get to it, though.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that this is a terrible idea.
Yes.
There seems to be like no creative vision around this. It's just, we got to get the IP. It's not like, Alfonso Cuarón or someone came in and said, I have a vision for how we can do this as a TV show. It's just like, David Zaslav is thinking, we got to get the IP refinery pumping. You know, we got to get this, all this stuff moving. And that's not a recipe for a great show. The other thing that comes to mind, of course, is also Amazon buying the rights for Lord of the Rings. Mm. Even they knew you do not mess with the thing that people already love and hold to be dear. They did not try to remake the original Peter Jackson films. They set their movie hundreds of years before those films. And so this idea that this show is kind of going to be gunning for essentially the original films in the hearts of fans, I think will create some consternation because it is very possibly going to be compared unfavorably to those films. Patrick Klepek, any thoughts before we hear Jesse's overall reaction to this?
I worry this is going to be exceedingly popular. Harry Potter is entering like deep in millennial nostalgia territory. They are people that are my age. Like, you know, I turn 40 next year. Like, it was a defining piece of literature and then cinematic films for people in their 20s, 30s, like teens. Like, it spans a long period of time. And I, in the same way that True Detective Night Country might have garnered a lot of attention, whether it was good or bad, I think it is a safe bet to say Harry Potter, a television series adapting those original books. By 2026, how long has it been between the first film? 15 years?
Yeah.
20 years?
Let's see. The first Harry Potter film was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, November of 2001.
That's a long time ago. If you look at Hogwarts Legacy, which was the exceedingly popular video game that came out at the beginning of last year, that succeeded essentially as being an interactive version of playing the original era. I know it's set before the like Harry Potter, but you're exploring a lot of the same thematic ideas, same geography, same feelings as those seven books, those eight movies. And so I expect that is a primary motivating factor is nostalgic millennials would love to revisit Harry Potter and would love to be mad about the casting decisions in Harry Potter as they watch it. So I don't defend it on the creative merits, but I understand from the business perspective, especially for that, the kinds of people that would sit and want to watch that, the appeal. And plus it's far enough away from 2001. Do young kids want to watch a movie from 2001? I don't know, but they might be more inclined to watch a modern television show.
They certainly a 2026 show on Max, the one to watch for HBO. They're going to
get all the kids.
That's where all the kids go, is what I understand. Max, the one to watch for HBO.
On the playground, constantly trading stories about Max.
Jesse, those are just a couple of creative/business thoughts about the new Harry Potter show that's going to debut on Max. But you actually have a very personal history with some of the people behind the show, do you not?
Yeah. I mean, before I get to that, I'll just add my two cents quickly into what you two said as well. It's just, it's frustrating because I would, like, if the stuff with J.K. Rowling aside that I'll get into in a moment did not exist, it's just like there is so much you could do with this world, like beyond just regurgitating the stories we've already seen. Like even the Hogwarts Legacy game, I have issues with that story, but like at least there was some level of like, this is somewhere different, doing something different, telling a different story. And I feel like that would have just been way more interesting to me. But you're right, Patrick. It is just trying to get the nostalgia, both positive and negative, because even the people who will hate watch are still watching. So that is very clearly the impulse there. But yeah, just a quick give a rant. I could go on for very long about it, and I don't want to override it. But obviously, you know, as a trans person, J.K. Rowling's involvement in this project is, and just Harry Potter just in general, is always going to be just the thing that overshadows all of it for me. Zaslav has continually, as they were like talking about the show, championed J.K. Rowling's involvement in the show, which is also weird to me, even beyond the transgender bigotry stuff, because it's just like, how did you not? Clearly he didn't. The Fantastic Beasts movies, where she was the main writer for those movies, and they were a mess of storytelling.
The thing that's also bizarre too is, theoretically, because they are covering the original books, Warner's has more creative control over those than, say, Fantastic Beasts or other prequel material that J.K. Rowling has exerted more control over. The material from the original books is like, Warner Brothers has a lot of cards
leeway with that.
But despite that, there's a story in Wall Street Journal that we'll link to in the show notes about how Zaslav is trying to uncancel J.K. Rowling, and he has continually sought her approval and her guidance and wants her to be a critical part of this new television series with all the good and bad that is going to entail.
Yeah. And kind of going to that uncanceling thing, like, I always hate the word canceling because it kind of implies this narrative that she had, and anyone who was canceled has ever lost any real standing, when most of the time it's just them claiming that to be able to frame like, oh, I'm being attacked, so they can then position themselves as like needing to be defended and propped up further. But yeah, I mean, just to quick mention it, like, J.K. Rowling has continually for years now been promoting anti-trans bigotry that has led both directly and indirectly to not only governmental policies, both in the United States and UK, that have directly cited her, that are attacking the trans community, such with anti-trans healthcare bills and things like that. But also her rhetoric has directly stoked bigots that have called for direct harm against the trans community. I mean, she's directly promoted folks like Posey Parker, who has done rallies against trans people and called for the death of trans people, and actually led to neo-Nazis marching in New Zealand, where she held a rally. So like, she is promoting people that are actively attacking the trans community. And we've seen an increase in violence, both, again, systemic and individual, against trans people, leading to like the death of a teenager recently in I believe Oklahoma. So that aspect of it is just to continually prop up both J.K. Rowling specifically, but also Harry Potter as a brand is difficult. And while I do understand to a degree people's complicated feelings about Harry Potter, I have my own feelings about Harry Potter, given that it's controlled by J.K. Rowling, and given that J.K. Rowling directly benefits from it, and she is one of the primary funders of money and also of rhetoric towards a lot of these anti-trans causes, it is deeply frustrating to continually see people like Zaslav. Not that I love Zaslav even beyond this, but see him.
He has been a paragon of virtue prior to this.
So. Yeah, exactly. So, to listeners, just to wrap out this, if you do want to, because some of the stuff I'm saying may be surprising to some people about J.K. Rowling, who may not paid attention to her bigotry, even though it's a lot of what her Twitter presence is nowadays. I did an article for GameSpot actually a year or so ago around Hogwarts Legacy, that the video game, that goes into a lot of my conflicting feelings and also a lot of this history with J.K. Rowling around that, that would, I think, equally apply to this Harry Potter show for Warner Brothers. Just replace Hogwarts Legacy with Warner Brothers Harry Potter, and the article, I think, very much applies. So I will just promote that article and say go check that out, because it'll give deeper and more specific thoughts around everything. So
yeah, and we will link to that in the show notes. Thanks for sharing that, Jesse.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, those are a few pieces of television news that are happening in the world right now.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right. Why don't we get to the recap and review portion of the podcast? And I want to start, as always, by saying that, like, telling people what we're covering this week and what we'll be covering next week. So this week we'll be talking about Constellation, episodes 1 through 3, and Shogun, episodes 1 and 2. And of those two shows, Shogun is the one that we will continue to cover weekly. But we will also have some coverage of Constellation finale in some form or another. Might be a bonus episode. We might integrate it into the main episode that week. But we will have some form of coverage of the Constellation finale, just not something we're going to cover week to week here on Decoding TV. So that is the homework for next week, is Shogun episode 3. And I do want to mention that we will probably be releasing episodes of Decoding TV a little bit later than usual, because Shogun comes out on a Tuesday. Most of the time, Patrick Lepik, we cover shows that come out on Fridays or Sundays, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a weird one, having a midweek debut of Shogun. But for reasons we will get into very shortly, I think it'll be worth it. So let's get into our coverage of Constellation on Apple TV+.
I'm very happy to be back home. But things are different. I have a piano in my house, and I don't play the piano.
Do you have hallucinations?
Mama?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about Constellation on Apple TV+. The first three episodes debuted last week. I think the fourth episode, it may already be available as we're recording this. But we are going to start in one sentence or less. Patrick Lepik, should people watch Constellation on Apple TV+?
I don't know. Because I don't know how it wraps up. And I mm-hmm. think that may be my short version of if I'm very curious to see how it wraps up. But in three episodes in, it's a big mystery box, and it's mm-hmm. going to live or die by how those things do or don't wrap up. So for now, I'm sort of maybe.
Jesse Earle, should people watch Constellation on Apple TV+?
I would say I agree completely with Patrick on that, with the asterisk of this show is my shit. I like everything about the show, like weird, weird quantum mechanics, check, like cool, like space sciencey stuff, check, weird horror visuals and possibly parallel worlds-y stuff, like check, like it is very much what I love about it. So I enjoyed this show very heavily. And if that's your jam, I would recommend it. But if it is not necessarily your jam, then I would agree with Patrick, like wait until the show is over, hear what people say, and then maybe check it out if people feel it wrapped up well.
Yeah, Patrick, I think you summed it up really well. This is a show that has one, two, possibly three central mysteries to it. I have a feeling they're somewhat connected. And by the end, we'll figure it out. But in the meantime, they're just showing you a lot of spooky things that are happening. Spooky things. And the spooky things are done pretty well. But essentially, it will all hinge on whether this mystery is satisfying and whether it's done well by the end of the show. And right now, we cannot tell you whether that's the case. But let's talk about what we actually do know about what happens in these few episodes. I'll just read the recaps on the Apple TV Plus app. In episode 1, The Wounded Angel, a disaster on board the ISS becomes a fight for survival. In episode 2, Live and Let Die, Joe races to find a way back to Earth before her life support runs out. Meanwhile, Henry, played by Jonathan Banks, is concerned about his experiment. And in episode 3, Somewhere in Space Hangs My Heart, the space agencies begin their investigation into the ISS collision while Joe struggles to reconnect with Magnus and Alice, her estranged husband and daughter. I should mention, of course, Joe is played by the great Noomi Rapace. I want to say MVP of the show. I mean, mm-hmm. she is committed to this role. She is giving it her all, regardless of how ridiculous some of the stuff that she has to do is. What did you think of Noomi Rapace's performance in Constellation, Patrick Lepik?
She's great. I mean, this is the kind of actor that you can just put a close up on their face and there's so much to read off of it. And the show hinges a lot on you reacting to her reacting to something slightly off and not necessarily having an answer to what that is. So it requires a certain actor to be, especially as you're, you know, depending on where you fall on the spectrum, as Jesse was saying, like in terms of your interest level in these core ideas, these core themes, these core, like, ooh, what's going on here? Like, depending on where you fall on that, then you have to start falling back on other things to maintain your interest in the show as you wait for more domino pieces to fall. And you can do far worse than her. Like, she is just a very compelling actor that is very good at looking slightly confused and horrified.
Indeed. I want to describe for you both my experience of watching the show. Now, the reviews came out before we actually are recording this. And so I would say a significant percentage of the reviews were negative on the show. One of our favorites, Alan Sepinwall, gave it a pretty negative review. And I think most of the reviews summed up to, this is the concept of a movie that was stretched out to be like an 8-episode long series, and it should not have been stretched out. That was kind of what a lot of the reviews said. And so I started watching, and longtime listeners of Decoding TV will know, I hate that shit. And so I started watching, thinking, I'm going to keep watching until I like start disliking this. And I mean, I'm going to finish the first three episodes because that's what we agreed on. But I'll probably stop after that because I assume I'm going to lose interest by episode three. So I watched episode one and I thought, actually, that episode rocks. That was an awesome episode. Then I watched episode two and three and I was thinking, I was waiting for me to start hating this. I was waiting for me to be like getting frustrated, and it never came. that moment never came. I kind of was still into it by the end of the episode, third episode. And not only that, there's some great stuff in the third episode. You know, as I mentioned, this investigation over what happens at ISS like goes on in the third episode, and there's all this bureaucracy of like what happens when you have three different countries trying to agree on the same version of events. And I found that to be fascinating. So by episode three, I'm still really into the show. Now, maybe it goes way downhill after episode three, but so far I'm still pretty engaged to my surprise. Let me ask you about episode one. I mean, I thought episode one was great. It felt like Gravity, you know, Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity style, thriller where something goes wrong in space and they need to deal with it. And I just thought it was really well done. Jesse Earl, what were your thoughts on the opening episode?
I agree. I think what makes the show work very well, because we've been joking about like all the spooky aspects and all of that stuff. Just keep using that phrase. And I have thoughts about like,
gotta say it that way too.
Absolutely. You can't just say spooky stuff. The characters say it in the show too. It's very weird. No, we've been joking about all of that, and I find that stuff super fascinating. It gets into like quantum mechanics stuff that I'll talk about later if we want to, because that's again very much my jam, and I love that stuff. But what I think makes this show work so well is that it grounds that in like actual hard sci-fi, like this workings of the ISS, seeing the daily lives of that, seeing of them having to deal with like when something goes wrong, like them having to deal with their life support going out, having to go and check out of the systems, like just the mundanity of something like that going on and dealing with the bureaucracy of it, grounding it in that, I think, is what makes it still stay intriguing moment to moment, so that when the weird stuff happens, you're not just like, oh, there's just a bunch of weird things happening, I can't connect to it. You're still grounded in the world that then makes the weird stuff feel properly weird. And so I think that that's what really makes it work. And going off of the first episode specifically, like just seeing them have to deal with this like just random catastrophe and them having to run around and just like dealing with stuff like having to try and help a guy as he's dying with his blood spraying everywhere in zero gravity. Like the show isn't overly gory, but it does have a little bit of it. Just seeing that sort of stuff was very thrilling to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. And also this weird situation where Noomi Rapace's character, Joe, sees what she thinks impacted their ship. a dead Russian cosmonaut. That's what she believes impacted her ship. And no one else sees it, right? And every Russian cosmonaut in the history of mankind has been accounted for. So what did she see? She was just seeing something. I did really enjoy when they're presenting what bags of trash look like in human form. They almost look like AI generated because it's like so close to what a human would look like. But it's like, imagine if we shaped a bag of trash like a human. Is it possible this is what you saw? Anyway, Patrick Klepek, did you enjoy the first episode?
I did. And the first episode has the least amount of the part that's bugging me throughout the other episodes, which is the show constantly feeling like it's getting a little ahead of itself to go, hey, shit doesn't seem right, does it? Huh? Like, seems a little weird, huh? Like, stuff's going on. And it's like, I feel like the show is like raising its eyebrows at me, like, don't think things are as they seem, do they, buddy? It's like, yeah, I'm aware, show. Like, I get it. I think maybe some of that has to do with having to dole out, you know, chop this up over the course of more episodes. We'll see as the show goes on how it manages that. But part of the reason the first episode works as well as it does is because it's like very concerned with the brass tacks of what do you do in the middle of a disaster. It's what makes Gravity work. It's what makes like this episode at its best work, which is you get to watch smart people do smart things in the face of great adversity or panic. And you get to see a bunch of smart people, including the rest of the crew, right? It's not just Joe. It's this entire crew of people dealing with something truly extraordinary before we have any sense of what are the potentially extraordinary events or supernatural, however the show ends up characterizing it, events that led to them having to deal with, well, his hand is cut, you know, connected to the spaceship now as everything falls apart. And I think that part of it is really, really compelling. And it's the balance between those things that I feel like is a little off in 2 and 3, but like works really, really well in that first episode.
Agreed. And the story continues into the second episode where she basically needs to find her way home against all odds. And she does. I will say I was a little bummed that the episode one begins with what is essentially a flash forward.
Yeah.
So we know that she survives. And it's like, yes, Noomi Rapace is on the poster. So we probably know that she's going to survive anyway. But it was still kind of like, I don't think we needed to see all that stuff in the first episode. You know, like the flash forward stuff. Like they could have held that back. Jesse Earle, you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, I have many, many thoughts. how do I say this? Because a question I would have is, but did she survive?
Yes, okay, there you go.
Because that is the...
It's a fair point, point.
A question that the show raises. Because and this is actually something, too, just jumping into this. The other aspect of it that I do like is that the weird stuff kind of... is buttressing her own emotional arc too. So we have the stuff with the weird, like, oh, she saw a Russian body that no one else saw. But then that leads into questions of like, do people believe her? Is she trusted? Does she trust her own memory? She's gone through a traumatic event. So like the weird elements of it are highlighting, you know, potential systemic biases against her as a woman, but also as like, just as like, do we trust people's observation of something? And which kind of goes into the idea of the observer effect, which again, it's, I love all these ties because we're talking about quantum mechanics. So there's the observer effect, which is something doesn't actually like particles will not resolve their state unless they are observed. Otherwise, it's like Schrodinger's box. The cat will exist as both alive and dead until the wave function collapses when observed. So like there's all these sort of things that kind of interweaving each other with each other emotionally and thematically in with the quantum mechanics that I thought was a lot of fun. And then, yeah, getting into your like, does she survive? It's one of those sort of are we allowed to do full spoilers? I don't know exactly what the rules are.
Full spoilers for the 3 episodes, not for any feature episodes.
Yeah. I haven't seen any of the future episodes. So I mean, there's this question of, since we're dealing with quantum mechanics here, and Jonathan Banks' character, who's also great in this, is talking about like how, you know, there's a new state of matter and all of that jazz. It gets into this possibility of alternate worlds that the show is kind of jumping between. So then the question becomes, it seems like she potentially didn't survive in one of the worlds. And that's why she has a different daughter in one. So it's,
right.
It's, yeah, there's, There's some or fun maybe stuff
there's
about
a, there's a universe where she survived and one where she didn't.
Yeah, you know? Exactly, exactly.
And that's why people think she's behaving very bizarrely, or she's essentially experiencing a different version of reality than other people mm-hmm. are, right?
And I would also even, oops, sorry.
Yeah, no, you go first. You go first.
I would also even say there's stuff like, I think the show may be playing with that as well, because we see in episode 3, two stories of Jonathan Banks, both him dealing with like the stuff going on the station, but then also him sort of dealing with being called up for his memory changing, like in what seems like a slight flashback. But then I also raised the question of like, maybe that's a different universe. Yeah, instead of an alternate or instead of a flashback. So there's just some fun structural stuff there too.
I loved all that ISS truth finding commission stuff in episode 3. I just thought that was so, it's such an interesting concept of what you would do if you're in that situation. You see mm-hmm. something that no one else believes you. They're literally throwing 15 different explanations at you for why you didn't see what you saw. And it's like in your benefit to just say, yeah, you're right. It was a bag of trash shaped suspiciously like a human. And that's what mm-hmm. it was, you know, because they're all just trying to avoid taking financial responsibility for something mm-hmm. impacting the ISS. Right. And so it's like a very fascinating idea. I also got to say MVP of the show. One of the MVPs of the show for me, other than Noomi Rapace, is the woman who plays the, I want to say, Russian boss. Irene Lyshenko, played by Barbara Sukhova. I wasn't really familiar with her work too much before this show, but she is just such a compelling presence and someone who I fear, you know, watching the show. It's like, I would be afraid of that person if they were on the other end of the testimony table. Let me ask you quickly before we move on to Shogun about the Jonathan Banks stuff. I was not a huge fan of like Jonathan Banks in the show so far. It seems really disconnected from, I know it's probably related, Jesse, but like plot wise, it seems really disconnected from the rest of the plot. You know, his part of the plot so far. The dialogue just feels really pretty clunky to me. Mm-hmm. Just not loving the Jonathan Banks of it all. And I love Jonathan Banks in Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. Patrick Klepek, how's Jonathan Banks as the character of what's his name, Henry, working for you in the show constellation?
Well, every time we get around him, we get to hear a big glowing object go it's pretty weird. Like, that object's probably doing some fucked up stuff, you know? Like, what could it be? Like, hey, show, it's okay, I get it, you don't like to be subtle. That thing is making like that, it does that on the ISS. Like, nobody thinks this, like, chip going, like, ga-dong, ga-dong is, like, no, we're good with that? It's just a little experiment? Okay, fine. I'm with you. Like, he's fine. It's hard to judge much of anything about his character and the arc, what he's putting into it as an actor, because I think so much is contingent on where it goes. It feels like later parts of the show pulled in sooner that will click, like, if done right, click into place and maybe are more satisfying with a little more hindsight, but only kind of functions as padding at the moment for a show that I think honestly would have been stronger if it doubled down on the elements that seem to work the best for all three of us, which are like the bureaucracy, like the operating of the shuttle, like all that stuff is strong. And at times I feel like the show is not confident in its ability to have that carry it, and is like, got to put this mystery. Like, it's almost like the buzzing of that chip or whatever it is the show lacking a confidence to just sit with that stuff for like, if you're going to be a slow show, be a slow show. I think it'd be a better show if it was sitting with that stuff and doling out its mystery box stuff. Even the, like, as you mentioned, David, the framing of the first episode and this cabin, it feels like it's just trying too hard to start up front with, like, it's stuff's weird, stuff's off, let's go right, find, like, out what happened.
Like, why would they feel the need to do that unless it feels like the show doesn't actually need to do that. It could have just started on ISS, don't do the mystery. Like, we can get to them. I have a feeling there's going to be plenty more mystery, spooky stuff later on. So, like, you don't need to drop it in the very beginning of the first episode.
The wave that happened, like, what's one of the most effective, like, spooky scenes, it's very subtle. It's not a jump scare or anything like that, is kind of like the hand wave or like the person she sees that, like, releases the latch as she's mm-hmm. trying to come back to Earth. And I couldn't help but keep imagining a show that allowed that stuff to land as more mm-hmm. shocking and spooky if the show wasn't so upfront about, hey, this is a show where some weird stuff's going to happen.
Right,
because like, I know that going into it, but yeah. I just wish it was a little more subtle, because it would allow moments like that to just mm-hmm. land like so much more shockingly and be so much more unsettling. But instead, I feel like all the time the show is just reminding me that, like, it's pulsing in my ear in the same way that Chip is. But mm-hmm. I do agree with Jesse, though, like, the fundamental, when I talk about the show, as we talk about the show, those building blocks sound really compelling, and I'm rooting for the show to put them together in an interesting way.
Mm.
Jesse Earl, you want to take us home on this one? Any thoughts on Jonathan Banks or any other overall thoughts on Constellation on Apple TV Plus?
No. I think I agree with Patrick completely. I do think that that when it hits really, really hard. I do agree the framing device of the cabin, it feels too symbolic rather than actually tying me in. It's like, ooh, here's a symbolic way to represent all the stuff that we're talking about here, rather than actually feeling grounded in anything. And I feel like that is a bridge too far. Other than that, like I said before, this show is very much my jam. Anytime a show has to explain the observer effect to somebody, I'm like, I'm in. I'm all in. So I really love this show, but I agree completely. Like, if it isn't exactly your niche, it's one of those, like, just wait until episode 8. I think it's an 8 episode show. Wait until episode 8 comes out. Look at the, like, spoiler free reviews that say, yeah, it hits the mark or it doesn't. And I think this show would probably work better in a binge rather than sort of a week to week sort of thing.
Absolutely. Completely agree there. I have one final thought on this, folks. You know, in the final episode, third episode, we get a flashback to Jonathan Banks' character doing what appears to be a panel with a conspiracy theorist. And then he gets very irritated at this guy. He goes over to his dinner table in full view of his friends and says, hey, let's take a walk. And then he becomes the last person to see this guy alive. And, you know, I've read an article. You ever read an article or, you know, watch a video or whatever that changes the course of your life? I read one such article, and it was about what happens when people fall off of cruise ships. And essentially, like, if you fall off a cruise ship, it's very difficult for you to survive. Because you only have, like, a few minutes, essentially, before, you know, you get hypothermia or whatever from the water. The ship usually doesn't, the ship has thousands of people on it. So it's usually not going to turn itself around, disrupt the schedule of thousands of people for a chance, maybe a tiny chance they might find you. After I read that article, I decided I'm never going on a cruise. You know,
wow, you just ruined cruises for me.
They're basically like mobile cities. You know, they don't have their own, they don't adhere to United States law. You know, they're basically mobile cities with their own legal system, where there is tons of alcohol everywhere, and it's just like, you know, people every year, certain number of people fall off cruise ships and are never found, or they're never, you know, they don't survive. And so, not going on a cruise ship. And so that's how I felt watching Jonathan Banks throw that guy off the edge. I'm like, that guy, it's going to be hours until his friends realize something is off. And then by then, he's gone. You know, like, it's there's nothing they can do. Anyway, you're welcome, everyone.
Yeah,
welcome.
Thanks for that. I have friends on a cruise ship right now. I appreciate that.
All right. Anyway, so that's the moral of Constellation. Don't go on cruise ships. Okay.
Yeah, I think that adds up. I think that mm-hmm. I agree.
Thank you.
Rather go to the ISS at this point.
let's get to our conversation about Shogun.
Do not be fooled by our politeness. Our bows are made of rituals. Death is in our air. And sea and earth. Just remember. We live and we die. We control nothing beyond that.
All right, this is our conversation at Decoding TV about Shogun, the new series that's just premiered on FX and Hulu. It's based off of the novel by James Clavell, which has already been made into a 1980s miniseries. Shogun takes place in 1600 when the Portuguese are profiting off trade in Japan, but their sworn enemies, the Protestant English, are also trying to find the country and unlock its potential. Now, I just want to check in with you all. Have any of you either read the Shogun books or watch the 1980 miniseries?
Nope.
All right, so none of us have had any exposure to the story before. In its heyday, Decoding TV was about, and still is about like reading the source material and kind of being able to compare the source material with the show. Then I looked at how long James Clavell's Shogun is, which is, I think, approximately 1,400 pages.
Ooh.
And I said, I'm not going to be able to catch up on this book in time. But I thought about it, and that is ultimately what our listeners deserve. They're not going to get it, unfortunately. All that said, Patrick Klepek, in one sentence or less, should people watch Shogun?
Oh, hell yes. I love this show as much as a character in this show loves studying the moment a person dies and seeing if they can figure anything else about it.
Jesse Earle, should people watch Shogun?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I agree completely. The show is, I was astounded. I was just finishing the first episode. We had two episodes to watch, and I was astounded by how much I was really just like, there's so much density to the show, and yet I feel like I understand all the characters, their motivations, and I'm fascinated to see where it goes. So yes, very much so.
This show is freaking amazing. I mean, it is some of the most excited I've been about a television show since Game of Thrones, right? I mean, it has that level of expertise and, seemingly expertise behind the world building. It is one of the most beautiful shows on television. It has one of the most rich cast of characters on television that I've seen. It's just a really amazing show. One of my favorite things about this is Sage Hyden, a video essayist, wrote on Twitter, "In the first creative meeting for Shogun, someone wrote on a whiteboard, what if a TV show had good lighting?"
Oh, that's a really good point. I mean, that's you jest, and yet, yeah.
And it's like, how many times have we seen a TV show that's like, this cost $180 million, and then it looks like, 99% of it was shot on the volume. I mean, this show looks incredible. Anyway, highly recommend watching Shogun. Who knows? They could still bungle it by the end, but like so far, I am so riveted, so thrilled. Would strongly recommend you check this out, and we will be following this week by week on Decoding TV. All right, let's talk about some of the stuff that actually happens on the show. We're gonna spoil the first two episodes, Anjin and Servants of Two Masters. We haven't seen any more episodes beyond this, even though we tried. We have not seen any more episodes. All right. The show revolves around several interconnected plot lines. The main plot is about how one of the leaders of the country with the title of Taiko has perished before leaving an heir that is old enough to rule. As a result, the country is left to be run by five regents: Sugiyama, who is descended from a rich family; Ono and Kiyama, who are both Christian, presumably converted by the Portuguese; Ishido, who is the caretaker of the castle; and one of our main characters, Toranaga, played by Hiroyuki Sanada, who is descended from the great Minowaras, the ultimate shoguns. Toranaga is an honorable man, but the other regents long for his downfall. But Toranaga has a few cards he can play. For one thing, he has an excellent relationship with the Taiko's heir. He also has say over where the heir's mom's whereabouts are, and he's ordered to release her from Edo, at which point the regents will presumably vote to kill Toranaga. So that's like one of the main plots. We'll talk about everything else that happens, but you know, this is Hiroyuki Sanada coming in, doing a main role, speaking primarily Japanese. I don't think the character even knows any English. I am, by the way, just impressed by how much Japanese is on the show. Like, they seem to be really... The only cheating I think the show does is when characters say they speak Portuguese, they're actually speaking English, right? That's
that's a fascinating... Like, that's a fascinating way to have some level of non-subtitling conversation to use that as. Yeah. Like, you call it a cheat, but I think cheating, complimentary. I think really smart way of... Like pulling that off.
It's interesting. They don't even explain it. Like, I remember I watched the first episode of Warrior recently. You guys seen that show? And in the very first episode of Warrior, everyone speaks Cantonese, and you see this guy speaking Cantonese to another guy speaking Cantonese, and the camera kind of twirls around them, and then when it gets to the other side, he's speaking English, and it's like, okay. So even though they're still speaking Cantonese in world, like, we're hearing it as English. And I was wondering if the show would do anything like that. Instead, they don't explain anything. They're just like, the Japanese characters speak Japanese and the white people speak English, even though it's actually Portuguese. But anyway, Toranaga, total badass. I've loved Hiroyuki Sanada in movies like Sunshine, and just a really talented actor. Patrick Klepek, let's start with you. Do you find Toranaga's plight, his predicament, to be something that's compelling in the show? And if so, why?
Well, I think, you know, it's a great compliment to the show, as Jesse pointed out, that you immediately empathize with and get on. Like, you explained the initial premise of the show and the amount of, like, religious and regional and cultural factions and tensions at work are... I find it more confusing to think about them than it is to just watch the show, because I think the show does an incredible job of just... Like, there's an opening crawl, and it's like, you're kind of like, what? Do I need to go to a Wikipedia page? Is this part of what this is? This show going to be homework? Is there homework attached to it? And there's not. I'm sure you can get more context and you can make it more interesting for yourself, but it's such a testament to the acting that, like, from the jump, you are in it with these characters. And that starts with, you know, the main actor we're introduced to here. And it just sets such a fast, like, this opening gambit of what this one character is up against this broader world. The fact that I knowing nothing about the story being told here, I'm like, yeah, I could watch a whole show about this. And then it just, like, there's so much more that it layers on after that. And yet it doesn't feel like it's juggling too much is a real testament to probably some combination of how it's adapting, but also just the core, you know, storytelling bones of the novel. But yeah, I was on board from the go.
I just think it's amazing that Hiroyuki Sanada is such an amazing actor. Basically, he always plays honorable people, like, in all of his movies. So in this show, it's like, oh, that's the good guy. He's the good one, right? Like, all the other ones are evil, but he is going to be the good one. Really appreciate that. Any thoughts on this whole? I think Patrick put it really well. Like, this show compresses a lot of information and exposition in a way that's very comprehensible to the audience. But Jesse Earl, any other thoughts on the Toranaga storyline?
No, I agree. I think, like, what I enjoy most about it is how it allows us, the audience, to figure it out first. Like, it gives some level of exposition as we get through it, but what it'll do is it'll often display, like, a scene without much context, and we sort of get the relationships between the characters. And then later on, even an episode later, it will give us more context and explanation to them that we can then latch on to what we had learned previously, instead of most shows where they'll establish, like, here's this guy, here's this guy, here's this guy, then we'll give you the scene. Because, like, for example, we have the four other regions that he has to go up against, and we just sort of meet them in their first confrontation, and we kind of get a little hint of who they are. And then in episode two, we get someone who does give us an explanation of, like, that's this guy, this is what he's about, there's this guy who has leprosy. Like, we do get those explanations, but then we can hook it into scenes that we had already seen, deepening those scenes from earlier, which I think is just really, really wonderful, and just adds, it just makes you get more and more involved in the show as you go, instead of feeling like, all right, I kind of got this. It makes you constantly, like, lean in to be more curious about it, which I think is a really awesome storytelling tool.
I think one of the most interesting components about the show, too, is part of the story that it covers is kind of the West's collision with Japan and like, you know, Japan entering modernity in some ways. And the opening scene really gets into that, where you see this guy who we'll talk about momentarily, John Blackthorne, who is an English pilot of the ship called the Erasmus, and they're looking for Japan, and they show up, and it was interesting to see guys dressed in samurai suits kind of being basically the cops of 1600 Japan. You know, it's like, oh, I'm used to these guys like fighting in battle in movies, but like they're basically like the police officers that show up and kind of assess what's going on, like, and you know, and that was a kind of interesting context. But there's this really spectacular shot where the camera pulls back from this character, this Japanese character, showing his perspective of the ship, and you see, you know, what the ship looks like, and cannons and weapons and all these other things that like are just, you know, seemingly way more common on these ships from Portugal or from England than the ones in Japan. And you sense like this is what this show is going to be about, is like the collision of these two worlds. I think it's a really interesting subject, and I think so far the show is doing a really great job of exploring it. Let's talk about the other plotline in the show. Torunaga is beset on all sides by his other regions, but a massive wild card might give him an upper hand. The second big plot revolves around John Blackthorne, an English pilot of a ship called the Erasmus, who's desperately trying to reach Japan. While he reaches his destination, his entire crew is taken hostage by Yabushige, who is a member of Torunaga's clan. Initially marked for death, it increasingly becomes clear that Blackthorne not only has information that can be of use to Torunaga, but his very existence as a Protestant can sow dissension among the regents, several of whom are presumably Catholic Christians. So curious what you guys think of Blackthorne as a character. I'm going to say this is a guy who started out, as my wife might put it, not understanding the balance of power. He shows up, he's very, you know, God grant me the confidence of a mediocre white English pilot, is what I have to say. He shows up really like just being like, I deserve to have all these things. And it's like, dude, you are so fucked right now. Like, you don't even understand how fucked you are. But ultimately, like, very thankfully, he very quickly learns like that he is completely out of his depth and he needs to have respect for what he sees around him. Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on John Blackthorne as a character so far?
I'm not sure if respect is the word that I'd use for how he feels about the world around her, as much as fear? It's sort of like fear, earned pragmatism as a result. But yeah, I'm with you. I adored just how fucking unlikable they make this guy, like, because you get the sense very quickly, like, oh, this is going to be a centerpiece of the show, and like, oh, he's kind of stuck over here with, again, like maybe our moral center, our good guy character. So, well, how's he going to kind of reform himself into sort of a swaggering, like, good guy, bad guy? And like, at every turn, the show is like, nah, he sucks shit. Like, this is a bad guy. Nobody should really be working with him. Like, all these people thinking they're going to use him as a tool really feels like this is going to backfire on them at some point. And yet his ability to kind of slither his way through a situation to get to the other side through a combination of kind of luck and his own ability to improvise is great. He's played exceptionally. This yet another Tom Hardy knockoff is played exceptionally.
Wow.
It's not wrong, though.
We're assembling a series of actors who, if I had a couple of drinks, I'd go, well, what's Tom Hardy doing in this one? I didn't know that he was here. And it's not
Cosmo Jarvis is the name of the actor.
Yes,
Cosmo
yes.
Jarvis.
Because the other guy who's the one is he was in who's the other one that looks? I'll look him up. He was in
the Spaniard guy.
No.
He was
the other
lost.
Tom Hardy knockoff.
The other Tom Hardy knockoff.
I think you're thinking of Logan Marshall Green.
I am thinking of Logan Marshall Green. So add him to the list.
And if you're really reaching like a Jai Courtney, might be also
sure.
Considered,
sure.
You know?
Yes. But yeah, I hope he stays an unlikable piece of shit, because that's what makes him endearing to me. Is I want him to get every time he gets the crap beaten out of him, and he just finds a way forward. Like, this is great television.
I will say, you know, I was not expecting to Google being boiled alive as punishment.
That was wild.
But yeah, at one point early on in the episode, one of his crew members is taken and boiled alive, which apparently was a thing that happened back then. So, you know, the more you know. And it's also done very horrifyingly. I'm just going to say, I know this is like a really bold stance, but I'm glad we stopped doing that as a species. I'm just going to put that out there. Jesse, Earl, any thoughts on the Blackthorn character?
I mean, I echo everything that Patrick said, but also what I really love about him is kind of what you were going to, David, is the show's central theme of the collision of cultures that we see with him. Because our very first scene with him, I think even before the opening credits, is him choosing not to die. He's like, well, I'm going to go for it. We're going to survive. The ship's going to make it. And he has that kind of like, again, that sort of stubborn persistence that kind of gets him through a lot of stuff. But then we also have this moment where he sees the lieutenant of Toranaga almost commit seppuku and almost kill himself when he's near death in the water, which kind of like shocks him, and he actually humbles himself at that moment. And it just goes to show him like recognizing like there is a distinct difference in culture and how that weaves throughout his entire character as he continually calls the Japanese savages throughout mm-hmm. numerous times, but then is also presented with the fact that like, no, these people are very sophisticated, very smart, much more than you quite often, but can also be guilty of savagery as well, like the boiling someone alive aspect as well. So I found that to be such an interesting, complex look at like just how cultures judge each other in different ways. Mm-hmm. And that's just a theme that runs throughout all of this. I find his character to be such an interesting foil to pretty much all of the other characters, and then also to the translation aspect. We talked about the Japanese and Portuguese / English in here, but then there's also scenes where he has to learn how to speak to Japanese folks without actually trusting his translators all the time. So he has to figure out ways to like, do I trust this translator? Are they going to translate correctly for me? There's that interesting tension as well. So just so many interesting dynamics constantly in play between not only Japanese culture and English culture, but also between Portuguese and English as well.
So far, I'm so riveted by those translation scenes.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, there's a monk or a priest basically Catholic priest who's doing the translating, and you hear him talking in the background and doing the translating, and then eventually like his voice fades away until it's just John talking in English, and then what's his name, Toranaga responding in Japanese, and it's like, and then it becomes like, and it's like, oh wow, that's so cool that like mm-hmm. it made that seamless transition. And then the second time where he's talking to Toranaga, it's Mariko who's doing the translating, and you know, it's specifically pausing to have her do the full translation every time, and obviously there's like character dynamics there that they want you to grasp. But I'm just really curious how the show's going to implement the rest of the translation scenes, because so far they've been really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
There are kind of so many scenes that I just want to talk, like I didn't want to do a full recap of like, I didn't want to do like a scene by scene recap because that would just take a really long time. But there's so many scenes I want to talk about. Let's start with one of Toranaga's men accidentally stepping out of line during his meeting with the regents and saying, you know, something like, how dare you insult Toranaga this way? And then Toranaga saying, how dare you imply that they insulted me? and he says, you're right, sir. In fact, as a result of my stepping out of line, I will now commit seppuku and also end my family line. And I just got to imagine that's an awkward conversation to have when you get home to the wife, you know? by the way, I'm committing seppuku, and also our son, he's got to go as well. Really, you know, I was debating this with some of my friends about how, like, seppuku doesn't require that you murder your children, I think, but like I think he's like, I brought so much shame to my family line that it would be better if my son were dead than if he were alive. And it's like, I don't think he really needed to throw that in as a bonus, you know what I mean? Like he could have just taken it on himself anyway. But that's to show you how hardcore this show is right up top, baby murdering is, or Is it honor killing? Like, maybe not murdering, but like, you know, this cute...
A baby is killed.
It depends on your perspective, Dave. Because, like, if I'm the baby, I have a great sense of being murdered in this moment. To everyone else, they might be like, oh, this is an honor killing. This is part of our culture. But if I'm the baby having my throat slit, strong murder vibes happening at the moment.
You as the baby might consider it to be... A murder. Like, it's
POV
true.
Murder from the baby's perspective.
I'm at least sitting here and just going, at least it didn't end with incest like Game of Thrones' pilot episode. Mm-hmm. So I guess baby murder is better. I don't know.
Everyone's got their different sex thing though. That is that is true of this show as well.
That is very true.
Not going to shy away from that.
Yeah.
Todayashi is the name of the character who kind of steps out of line and. He accidentally misspeaks during a meeting and as a result needs to kill himself and his baby. Really costly mistake. There's Hiromatsu, talking about some of the side characters. Hiromatsu, who's like this old dude who's a loyal friend to Torinaga. There's a scene where he confronts Yabushige about the fact that he's seized the Erasmus and its contents. Amazing scene, I thought. There's this moment where he says to Yabushige, hey, you got to give us all the cannons and all the weapons and all the stuff that you found. And Yabushige is like, well, all that stuff belongs to me. And then Hiromatsu says, well, I thought you were loyal to the House of Torinaga. And then like all of his men slowly reach for their swords subtly. Like you can see them all like grasp their swords subtly. And it was like, what an amazing subtle touch to that scene. I love that. But it seems like, I'm not predicting great things for Hiromatsu. Let me put it that way. I think his alliance to Torinaga is going to be costly. And then, of course, there's Mariko, who's married into General Torinaga's family over a decade ago and has now been chosen by Torinaga to be a translator. Patrick Klepek, I think the actress who plays Mariko, wasn't she also in the Monarch
Legacy
show,
of Monsters? Yeah, it's fascinating having watched those shows back to back where in Monarch, she's speaking mostly in English. Obviously there's a strong central component of Japan in that show, but she's largely speaking English. And here, complete opposite, and just fascinating.
Anna Sawai is the name of the actor. Yeah, but
Just really fascinating from an actor's like perspective to watch these shows in such close proximity, and yet this actor, performing in such a different sort of venue.
Yeah. Any kind of side characters or plots that stick out to you all as we think about the events of the first two episodes? I'll just also mention, I really like Yabushige as as a character. Like, it's just a really strong swagger that character has. Perhaps best demonstrated when there's a scene where he kind of rescues Blackthorn from being executed. By sending a bunch of bandits to kill all of the executioners. And then he then turns around and then murders all the bandits, which I think is just a really badass demonstration of his powers.
But I have never seen a character more scheduled to die at some point than that guy. Like, and it's going to be awesome. Like, it's going to be a sick death. And this is not a spoiler. I have no idea. But like, just, like that kind of like arrogant, swaggery character is like, oh, come on. You're not lasting.
They're the first to go.
You're not making it to the end.
They're the first to go. Jesse, are all any thoughts?
I was actually going to say, too, I love that character. Not even just for that scene, too, but he's also the character that we were alluding to before where he's like curious about the moment of death. So that was the boiling pot scene. That was him, correct?
Yeah.
And so there's that aspect of him that's weirdly morbid. But then also he has just interesting loyalties, too, because he's technically one of Torinaga's lieutenants, but he also is friends with one of the other regents that he sort of like the reason he went after the bandits was not for Torinaga, but for the other guy.
Yeah,
it does
yeah.
benefit Torinaga as well.
Yeah.
So there's just he is.
I think it's Ishido is the other guy that he's.
I forget his name.
I think that's who the regent that he's with. Yeah. Anyway, but
the sort of lead regent in against Torinaga, kind of to a degree. Though his loyalties is also kind of in the middle. Anyways, he just is an interesting character to me just because of his playing both sides against the middle. sort of vibes that I find very, very interesting. And I actually kind of get a different vibe. I could actually see him being kind of the little
he's
the
in
little
the throne
finger.
At the end.
No, yeah. more like the little finger. If we're going to compare to Game of Thrones, like the character who just kind of plays everybody and gets further than he probably should. But probably
well, nothing bad happened to Littlefinger.
Oh yeah, definitely doesn't make it to the end. Definitely doesn't make it to the end. But I definitely see him potentially lasting longer than some. So.
For me, that what comes to mind immediately is less of a specific character or subplot. Although I will say, this show, two episodes in, is already at the point where this happens later in like a season's arc. But like, you could take any number of these characters, and it's like we're just doing a one-off episode about them. We're just following them around.
Yeah.
Like, I already am so invested in so many of these characters that we could just do the POV episode already with a bunch of them, and I'd be fine. Which is, I think, a real testament to how nuanced this world is and how immediately attached you get to a bunch of these characters. But what I found myself so compelled by is the show, by very nature of the context and the cultures that it's playing with, is like deeply interested in opinions about religion. It is not just sort of, oh, it's here is texture. No, people got opinions about God. And like, which God? And like, fuck that God, fuck that. You know what I mean? Like, and because clearly, like, the institution of religion and how that is weaponized, like, is going to be a central component of this show and how that is used as sort of like a form of like cultural oppression and assimilation. And I'm very interested to see how religion and how, like, you know, this has been pushed upon a lot of these people. Plays out going forward, because I think that is one of those trappings that's playing out over everybody. But I like the fact that it's not just oh, religion is bad. It's like very specific thoughts on religion and the role it plays in people's lives, more than just, you know, a sense of what happens if one dies, but how that is wielded culturally and weaponized. I think is going to be very interesting.
Right, and a few things worth pointing out about that. Right, Blackthorne is Protestant, right? And the other, the Portuguese are Catholic, and they all kind of have this disdain for each other. People call Blackthorne the heretic. I think it's worth highlighting that the regents are ready to vote on Torunaga's death. They're like, hey, all right, guys, it's time to vote on Torunaga's death. And then one of them is like, we gotta kill this Blackthorne guy first. And it's like, really? Can't we do the Torunaga death first? And it's like, nope, it's so important that it overrides anything else on the docket. But yeah, I do think it is that important to them. They feel extremely passionate about it. Meanwhile, Torunaga's like, but wait, don't you both believe Jesus is God? Like, why are you killing each other again? Which I think is a very reasonable question to ask for an outsider. So anyway, on that note, I got to say, I was a huge fan of the final, like one of the final scenes, or both of the, you know, the concluding basically 15 minutes of episode two, where Torunaga gets another audience, or Blackthorne gets another audience with Torunaga, and he's asked to draw a map of the world in the garden. And that's just such a cool idea of like, how did people understand the planet back then? And obviously they have different levels of understanding of the planet. That's why Torunaga is kind of asking in some ways for help and information. And I just thought that was totally fascinating, that like essentially Japan is waking up to this like wider world that it is completely unaware of at this point. And you know, I just, as usual, it all starts going downhill when the white people show up. I'm just going to put that out there, you know? I have a feeling, I mean, to be fair, things were already not in great shape, according to the show, in Japan at this time anyway.
Well, but I don't think the white people are going to help. You know, I don't think they have the solutions. You know, I mean, like, yeah, maybe you got, maybe all y'all were going to fuck it up anyway, but I think we're just going to fuck it up more, so.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And got to say, final scene of the episode, totally badass. An assassin is sent in to murder. So one of the regents sends in an assassin to murder John Blackthorne, because that's how important killing John Blackthorne is. They're willing to risk war among the regents just to kill John Blackthorne. I think it's identified as Kaio the Maid is the assassin. And that scene is fucking awesome. It's just this woman storming from set to set, just slitting people's throats in like the most graphic, completely innocent. It's just like the servants, right? She's just murdering them left and right. It's gruesome. It's horrifying. It's incredible. I loved it. Jesse Earl, any thoughts on the scenes I've mentioned or anything else we've discussed?
No, I just will double down and say the show is fantastic and everyone should watch it. Easy contender for my show of the year so far.
Yeah.
Because it's fantastic.
Patrick Klepek, any other thoughts on Shogun first two episodes?
To your point, I think part of the reason that final scene is, other than it being exceptionally well shot and staged, and it'd be thrilling all on its own, even if you were to watch it out of the context of the show. One of the things this show invites really positive comparisons to, especially the early seasons of Game of Thrones, is that there's not a lot of action in these first two episodes. In the sense that, like, if you were to look at the artwork and you see like these big ass armor, and you're like, oh, we're going to war, baby! Like, this is gonna be, and I'm sure those scenes are coming. But what this show is getting right early, and what Game of Thrones, the reason it became such a phenomenon, and was able to delivered on big, spectacular, satisfying action scenes. But those scenes worked and were so memorable because you cared about those characters and it earned its way to those moments. And this show seems to be following, or at least the source material, how it's adapted. You know, I can't speak to that, but it's following that blueprint. And that's a really exciting blueprint, because that's a cool, if you just to take that YouTube clip, show it to somebody, maybe you're trying to sell them on Shogun as a show. And it's like, look at this cool scene. It's a cool scene, but it's so much more impactful because of the context and what it sits in, and the fact that the show chooses its moments so wisely with when things amped up that they just gain so much more intensity and prominence, because that's just not what the show is about. And the fact that you care about these characters in this world first and foremost is going to make every time it chooses to, like, it's going to feel exciting when like something happens, because it's going to be a rarity. It's a treat, or it's a punctuation on moments it's been building to, as opposed to like the reason you're watching it in the first place. So that's a really exciting place to be with a show like this.
I completely agree. I mean, it's rare to have a show. You've listened to the Decoding TV episodes. It's rare that Patrick and I watch the first two episodes of a show, and we're like, we are on this train no matter where it leads.
Yes.
Or usually if we do, it's with much more reluctance. But this time, I am so excited to be watching the show and talking about it each week. I think it's going to be, at the very least, very interesting. And the first few episodes have been very promising. So a couple of other just random things I want to bring up about the show. But before we do that, why don't we tell people where they can find more of your work on the internet? Jesse Earl, let's start with you. Where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube. If you type in Jesse Gender, you'll find me there. I have a bunch of video essays on there. I just did one recently about the depiction of colonialism within Avatar The Last Airbender, the live action show on Netflix, and how it fails to really live up to the theme of the animated series. I am also on all of the social medias. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and all of that jazz. And then I am also on Nebula, which is a streaming service that is funding my upcoming science fiction film Identities, which will be releasing later this year. And I am currently in the middle of doing VFX for. So that is my current hell. But it's a fun hell to be in, so I'm excited for that. So check that out.
Patrick Klepek, how about you?
I can follow all my talk about video games and sports over at remapradio.com. And you can sign up for my newsletter, Crossplay, about parenting and gaming at crossplay.news.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, consider becoming a paid member at decodingtv.com. Help to support the show, keep it going, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and bonus episodes. And we're on all the social platforms at Decoding TV. Follow us on there. Get some video clips and watch, enjoy, share those. We'd really appreciate that. All right, couple last things to bring up about the first couple episodes of Shogun. I want to say, love the character of Rodriguez. Thought he was a super cool Portuguese sailor. Like, you think you know how that subplot's going to go, where he kind of takes this guy, and then Blackthorne proves himself on the ship as a worthy pilot, and then Rodriguez will then say, oh, well, you are clearly worthy of being my friend. Nope, that's not how it unfolds in the show. Blackthorne proves himself, but then Rodriguez basically betrays Blackthorne, is my understanding, right? Like, he says, hey, we're not friends, and I'm turning you over to the authorities. So I liked how it kind of subverted that, you know, trope really right off the bat. Mm. Anyway, just loved Rodriguez as a character. Don't know if you guys have any
more
thoughts.
More lost act. I hope they're adding a new actor for every episode of Shogun. Like, I'm rooting for it. Let's go for 3 for 3.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who are the others, just to be clear? There's Hiroyuki Sanada, right, in Lost as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then I forget the actor. The one you just mentioned, Rodriguez, is also in Lost.
There's also a Stargate actor in there as well. My nerdy heart was very happy. He appears, he's the, I think, one of the Portuguese sailors working with the Catholics in episode 2. He's an actor from Stargate Universe, if anyone remembers that show.
Nestor Carbonell is the name of the actor.
Yes, Guyliner, as he was referred to in Lost.
And then there was this kind of odd scene about Yabushige, who I think we learn one of his kinks, right? He's like into watching people have sex. Is that right?
Sure.
I think he learns his kink in that scene. I didn't think he discovered it until that moment.
He's like, I'm into this. You know, he's like,
because he is upset at first, right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly goes, well, maybe this is my horny.
Maybe this is who I am.
But anyway, Yabushige kind of really getting, like, he's a full fleshed out character, that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
his fascination with death and his kink of watching people have sex, and also just straight up murdering dudes left and right and playing both sides. Definitely one of the coolest characters in the show.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I feel like he'll be a fan favorite.
Yeah, I think so as well. And also, like, I just want to dive into this thing about the moment of death. He has this fascination with death, and he's like, if I torture this guy enough, maybe I can learn, get some insight into kind of the death process. Was that kind of your interpretation, Jesse?
Yeah, that was kind of my interpretation of that. Because he said something right when the guy dies, he says something like, oh, the moment came and nothing happened. So I think he's sort of looking to feel if there's something at that, like, where is that moment and what does it feel like and what is it going to be? Which, kind of interestingly, I'm curious to see, the show doesn't directly tie it in any way, but I'm curious to see if it'll tie it into the other religious aspects of the series going forward. It hasn't been presented there yet, but I'm curious to see if that'll be brought more explicitly forward.
I think what happened with that guy who was getting boiled alive was, I think he knocked himself out by slamming his head against the side of the cauldron.
Yeah, I think he was trying to get knocked out or just die right there instead of having to deal with it. That was rough. That was rough to watch.
And it showed his, like, face melting as well. Yeah,
it was actually, like, remarkable restraint in,
right,
like, how, like, it was so much more horrifying to just have these, like, a several minutes of scenes play out where you just hear him screaming, like, for what I imagine was hours on end.
Yeah, it's just like, it's a time, not time lapse, but it shows it's during the day and then cut to it's night and he's still screaming, you know, and it's
bad way to die.
It's also, too, that just to give it, like, an arc of that, why it's so horrific, too, beyond just the visuals of it, which is also very restrained, too. There's only, like, a couple instances of that shot, and it's really impactful.
Yeah.
He is screaming, I want to live. Like, he's basically like, please don't kill me. I don't want to live. And then the very next thing you see him is him trying to die because it is so horrific. And that, just even those two points are, like, that just proves how horrific it is.
Yeah. I think the way the show uses violence is pretty interesting. You do get the sense that life is nasty, brutish, and short. There was one moment that I was quite confused by, but I don't know if you guys
the guy had who comes up reaction to pray for him for Blackthorne or whatever, that one moment.
Right. So they're leading Blackthorne through the town, and then I watched this scene like 4 times because I was trying to understand what happened. This somebody steps in and says, "Hey, why is that guy being taken prisoner?" Right. Mm. And then a separate dude steps in and kind of does the cross symbol in front of him. And then that dude's head gets cut off. Not the dude that spoke about, like, why is he being imprisoned? And so it was a little confusing to me, but I think it was just basically like, anyone who kind of interferes.
Yeah.
What's going on, you know, like, you're going to get your head cut off pretty much.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you all had a, because the way it was shot and edited was kind of bizarre, where this guy steps in. It's like, hey, what are you doing with that guy? Why are you taking him prisoner? And then like, and I think to myself, oh, that guy's going to get his head taken off. But it's actually this other guy that steps in. He gets his head taken off after doing the cross in front of John Blackthorne. So anyway. And yeah, those are just a couple of the other moments that I wanted to bring up. And if there's nothing else, I think we can wrap it up there. But Shogun, episodes 1 and 2, awesome show. Tune in for more conversation about this show on next week's episode of Decoding TV. They are Jesse Earle, Patrick Klepek, and I am David Chen. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Goodbye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.